Welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. It was in 1867 that a gentleman named Edward Callahan would introduce the stock ticker, which would allow us to effectively transmit prices, and or share prices in particular. This was initially transmitted by telegraph instead of by the exchanges and by the messengers of the exchanges. The word ticker itself comes from the sound that the machine, the telegraphing machine, would make as it printed the updated figures. Quite an interesting fact around the history of some of our markets. I'm Jimmy Moyaha. This is the SAFM Market Update. Let's get you up to date. Coming up on the show today, we take a look at the world of soybeans. South Africa confirming that they would be looking to export around 200,000 tons of soybeans to China before the end of this particular year. Quite an interesting development from the agricultural conversations that we've been having around finding new markets. We also have a conversation with the team at MedShield Medical Scheme. We speak to the principal officer of the scheme on the performance of that scheme throughout the financial year and what it is that they they looked forward to around the performance of the year that they can carry into the new year. We have a conversation with Standard Bank's Felicia Singh around the deal announced by the African Development Bank and Standard Bank, 5.4 billion rands towards small and medium-sized enterprises in South Africa. Then we have a conversation with the Chief Executive Officer of the Minerals Council of South Africa on the beneficiation rule that is before Parliament for consideration. The Minerals Council of South Africa expressing some concerns around whether or not this rule would be in the best interest or might have potential unintended consequences for the mining sector. Then we wrap up the show, as we do every Thursday, with a small business conversation. This week we get to know a business called Boo Campus Media a little bit better. We speak to the company's founder and chief executive officer and try and get a sense of how it is that that business is doing and what it aims to serve.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Ordinarily, we'd kick off the conversation with a markets discussion. Our market watcher is having some technical issues, so we will come back to that markets discussion. We will get straight into the soybeans conversation that we mentioned at the top of the show. The South African market set to export 200,000 tons of soybeans to China in November of this year, making it only the second soybean export deal that we've had with China. This is off the back of the increasing demand for finding new markets and dealing with conditions that have been prevailing in global markets. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with Executive Director at SA Cereals and Oilseeds Trade Association, Andre van der Veer. He joins me on the line now to get a sense of this and what we make of these developments. Andre, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. This is quite an interesting deal to move, especially for the agricultural landscape that has been on quite a clear drive to find new markets amidst the tariff uncertainty around the world. Where is the appeal for soybeans?
Thank you, Jimmy, for having me. Yes, certainly we're very pleased with this transaction. I must add that we had the clearance with the exports to China for a while. But as the commodity cycles move up and down, it's not always possible, depending on how good the crop was and so on. But even this year, we saw at the early stage that there will be some surplus crop for soybeans and for maize. And so because of late rains and so on, there was a lag in terms of harvesting, and we were not sure if we'd be able to export. But fortunately, this transaction realized. And soybeans is particularly good for the commodity business. It's a more profitable commodity. And China is a very huge market. And we first opened that market in 2023 with some exports, but we haven't had an opportunity after that because of some bad weather in the agricultural business. And this is the first time that we had that opportunity again. But we do also export to other markets. And that has been a drive, as you mentioned, in the last couple of years. Markets like Malaysia and Bangladesh, mostly in Southeast Asia.
Andre, can we take a look at the impact of the tariff conversations that have been happening around the world? We know that China's recently introduced their zero tariff preference scheme, and that sets to benefit this market and other markets by a great deal. Soybeans were previously subjected to a 3% duty, and on that 3% alone, this one shipment that we're talking about, or this one transaction that we're talking about, is saving almost 50 million rand at least, just on the fact that the tariff is no longer there. Can we just look at the tariff conversation in the broader context? Our agricultural sector, our farmers and our producers in South Africa are amongst the best in the world, and for them to tap into new markets is essential, especially with markets like the US potentially becoming more difficult to do business with. How do we expect that these tariff adjustments and perhaps these new relationships could benefit the agricultural space?
Yeah, it definitely benefits us. The commodity business is very competitive. Our natural markets are Southeast Asia, including China, a little bit further east, and some other countries further, even further east. So that little bit of an incentive of this $15 more or less per ton was enough to successfully negotiate this transaction. Although often it does come over a period of time with commodity cycles, and we have the JSE Futures Exchange, and you can in fact hedge your transactions a little bit in advance when prices are low, but often that is just not enough. So in this case, this is an added benefit, and the preferential trade agreement with China is indefinitely for now for most of the countries, but for us it's until 2028. So we're definitely planning on utilizing it again, but it will go in cycles. So now currently prices have moved a bit higher, although this transaction was fortunately secured in time. But we'll talk about the El Nino and the possible impact on prices and so on. I don't think we'll see this season another transaction, but hopefully next season. We are not so much worried about the American tariffs in this for the commodity business, because our markets are in the east. And in fact, we are competing with the U.S., Brazil, and Argentina on the export scene. And therefore, China is very ideal for us. It is a high-volume market. They are importing about 100 million tons of soybeans. We produce only about 3 million tons, but still, if we can secure a rather large transaction for us, then China is definitely the country to go to. The other transactions are small transactions, small shipments, and so on, but if you want to do volumes and you can get into the Chinese market, then that is certainly where you want to go.
Andre, before I let you go, I want to take a look at the El Nino conversation that you touched on. I mean, there are some serious concerns, at least in the agricultural landscape, around the potential impact that this could then have as we go into what some might call a super El Nino cycle of weather. I want to get your thoughts from an agricultural landscape around potential risks this poses towards production, towards crops, towards how it is that you navigate these times as the agricultural sector, especially if you have those standing agreements, like you said, that offtake on the produce, and you need to ensure that you're able to deliver on those.
Yeah, I think we should take it serious. But fortunately for us, there are two factors that are in our favor. The one is that we come out of a very good year, so we'll have ample stocks in the basic commodities like maize and soybeans. Even with this transaction, there should be enough soybean stocks for the country. Markets normally predicts and preempt this sort of movements, so we've already seen the prices moving higher to kind of curtail some of the exports. And in case of soybeans specifically, we won't see really more exports, so that there's enough stock for the local market as well, not to threaten our own food security. And then the subsoil moisture is very good. So even if there's a drought coming, we should be able to handle most of it together with the stocks and so on and the higher prices. But yes, it could have disastrous effects if it is really a super El Nino. And depending on how the rainfall does come down, you know, early season or late season and the heat waves and so on, so we should take it serious.
Lots to look forward to, lots to be optimistic about, especially in the world of soybeans, new markets being unlocked and tapped into from a South African agricultural perspective. This is what we hope to see from a resilience perspective and how it is that we make the most of the global dynamics as they play out. We'll leave this conversation on that note. André van der Pfeiffer, Executive Director of the South African Cereals and Oilseeds Trade Association, joining us to take a look at the latest soybean deal between South Africa and China.
With a complete view of your finances, Nedbank Private brings every aspect of your financial life together to create solutions tailored to your evolving needs. From private banking and lending to long-term financial planning and wealth management, Nedbank Private supports you at every stage of your financial journey. While others see only part of you, we see all of you. See money differently. Nedbank Private. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This interview is brought to you in proud partnership with MedShield Medical Scheme, your trusted partner for life. Visit medshield.co.za for more information. MedShield Medical Scheme released their financial results and presented their audited results for the 2025 financial year last week. We're going to be discussing these results and unpacking the performance of the business in a bit more detail with the principal officer of the scheme, Kevin Aaron. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of their performance. Kevin, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. Quite the year for the medical scheme, especially in a time where medical schemes might be finding it a bit more challenging to maintain business levels and maintain profitability levels. Standout year for the business. Take us through kind of your thoughts around how you felt the business performed.
No, thanks very much for being on the show. You know, very stagnant industry where, you know, even if you look at the Council for Medical Schemes, their last annual reports, it showed that there was only about 0.5% growth in the medical scheme industry. And we all know the economic challenges that South Africans are facing in terms of affordability. MedShield had an incredible 2025 year. You know, it really, we fired on all cylinders, so to speak. You know, and if I look at it, and I'll give you some numbers which we can unpack, but, you know, if you think 2025 was good, looking at the end of July 2026, it's looking even better. So, you know, in terms of growth, again, in a market that's not growing, we grew, you know, 5.3% in terms of lives year on year. We ended the year in 2025 with just under 146,000 lives on the scheme, which was nice growth, as I say, 5.3%. And I think very few medical schemes can sort of show that sort of growth. But I think what was important is that, you know, it was consistent growth. So, you know, in 2025, we had 11 of 12 months net membership positive growth. And, you know, if I go back just to January 2024, the scheme has experienced 27 months of net positive membership growth out of a total of 31. So it actually shows an incredible trend where month after month, members or consumers are actually choosing to join MedShield because they see value for money. And we see that in the membership growth. Sort of I'd end off and then, you know, allow you to question me more. But to say, you know, at the end of 2025, as I said, we ended the year with just under 146,000 beneficiaries. By the end of July 2026, we're just under 160,000 beneficiaries. So you can even see that into the 7 months of 2026, we're actually showing incredible growth. We've had growth every single month for 2026. So, you know, it's a great news story for us, and we're very happy with that growth. And when you combine that with probably one of the highest solvency levels of all the large open medical schemes in the industry, things are really looking positive for MedShield.
Kevin, what's the secret? Because you touched on growth and, I mean, 4.5% membership growth from a business perspective in that stagnant market that you mentioned at the start of the conversation is one thing. But to be able to kind of keep premiums at a manageable level while still growing the business, where's that balance? How does the business strike that balance between profitability, doing what is best for the members, and ensuring that the entity itself is not put in a precarious position?
No, it's a great question. And in fact, it is a balance. I mean, you know, so I think one of the things we focus very heavily on in terms of, you know, our marketing and who we market to is we try to attract younger people into the scheme because the whole principle of a medical aid is based on cross-subsidization. So, you know, the young subsidize the old and the healthy subsidize the sick. And invariably, you know, if you get young people into your scheme, typically they're going to claim less than older people. So we've been very, very successful through digital campaigns and through our marketing effort, pitching a value proposition to younger people. And most of the people that are joining MedShield, we actually see are significantly younger than the average age of the scheme. I think one of the reasons for success is that we offer what we call a traditional medical aid plan. So what you see is what you get. It's not what I would call a smoke and mirrors where it's so complex that you don't understand it. And then when you claim, you actually find the medical aid is not paying. So we've always gone in our 50 plus years with traditional options. There's benefit limits for dental, for optical. People can actually see exactly what they're getting for what they're paying. And, you know, maybe it's just a lot of luck, but I think it's also good management and good pricing. You know, we've been able to maintain that high solvency and still keep contributions affordable. I would also just say that the culture of MedShield is such that, you know, we're very stable and very cautious in our approach to our pricing. So, you know, you won't find with MedShield that in 1 year there's a 3 or 4% contribution increase and the next year you're going to get a 12 or a 15. We always try to maintain within a level of, you know, around about 7, 7.5%. And I think that also is what people like. They know that typically every year it's going to be in the same region.
Kevin, before I let you go, I want to talk more about that consistency element of what it is that the business tries to achieve. But I want to look specifically at products and products going forward. We are in a time where conversations around national health insurance are coming up. We're in a time where the needs of members are changing in the sense that different members have different requirements and might need different things from their medical scheme. How do you then position MedShield as a business going forward to continue to benefit from this momentum, regardless of how the external environment might shape up?
Yeah, so, I mean, look, one can never say never, but, you know, I'm very skeptical that we'll see something like a national health insurance in at least the next 10 to 15 years. I just think it's not going to happen and it's going to take far longer. And there's just so much litigation and uncertainty around pricing. And we all know that the public healthcare sector is having its own challenges. So, you know, for us, it's very clear that, you know, there's a foreseeable future for private medical aid. So we have to have a strategy going forward. And I think the strategy is built around health innovation, technology, both technology in terms of the actual administration. So you get efficiencies through technology, robotic automation, artificial intelligence, which pulls your non-healthcare costs down. And then obviously what we're seeing a lot more is technology that's coming out to help us manage the cost of healthcare. So predictive models, models that can actually predict which members on the scheme are going to potentially go into hospital. We can actually engage with those members at a very early stage to ensure that they're under control, they're taking their medication, they don't end up in hospital where suddenly the costs become exponential. I think, you know, for us, the future is very much the corporate market. It's a market that we need to do a lot better in. And a lot of our focus in terms of product design going forward is going to be, you know, how do we capture the corporate market so that people in blue chips, both from executive level all the way down to the ordinary employee, actually says, you know, MedShield offers a range of products that actually meets our needs. I think at the end of the day, you know, and I talk to people all the time, even people who are in executive positions, you know, and they say, I'm paying so much for my medical aid. So a big focus for us on is always going to be affordability and trying to keep those contribution increases to the lowest level. We're very lucky. I mean, if I just give you an example, in 2024, we had a 61% solvency, which is significantly higher than the 25% that the council want as a minimum. And at the end of 2025, it was 53%. And one of the reasons that our solvency dropped slightly was that we actually subsidized some of the contribution increases for 2026 because we understood the needs of the members in terms of affordability and the challenges. And, you know, still having a solvency of 53% gives us a little bit of wiggle room, even for next year, to potentially look and again subsidize those contribution increases so that, you know, we help the consumer and we help our members.
A strong 2025, but a greater focus on ensuring affordability and sustainability for all members. That is what the team at MedShield has to say about their previous year's performance and where it is that the business is headed. Thanks so much to Principal Officer of the Medical Scheme, Kevin Aaron, for joining us to take a look at their performance over the last year and what it is they're looking forward to. For better healthcare today and tomorrow, choose MedShield Medical Scheme, your trusted healthcare partner for life. Join today. Visit medshield.co.za. The markets move fast, but your health shouldn't be left to chance. That's where MedShield comes in. From MediCurve for young go-getters to MediValue for growing families, right up to comprehensive cover on MediPlus, there's a choice of 8 plans built for your life stage and your budget. Don't wait for the unexpected. Go to medshield.co.za to find the option that fits your life. Need more information? Visit medshield.co.za today. MedShield. Your partner for life.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
This feature is brought to you by the Standard Bank Group. The team at Standard Bank has announced a landmark partnership with the African Development Bank, the development finance institution on the African continent, a 5.4 billion rand deal aimed at supporting small and medium-sized enterprises, specifically in South Africa. We're going to be taking a look at this particular announcement in a bit more detail with the head of client experience, insights and adoption at Standard Bank South Africa's Business and Commercial Banking Division, Felicia Singh. She joins me on the line now to see what we make of these developments. Felicia, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Now, the understanding from what has been announced around this 5.4 billion rand deal is that potentially for the first time since the introduction of this type of instrument by the South African Reserve Bank, a FLAC instrument is going to be used to support small businesses. What is a FLAC instrument and how does it relate to small businesses?
Thanks, Jimmy. So FLAC stands for Financial Loss Absorbing Capacity, but actually let me just get into explaining the deal in simple terms. So the deal between Standard Bank and African Development Bank is actually a two-part deal. The first part of it is that 5.4 billion facility that you've just mentioned, which is a FLAC instrument. And in simple terms, a FLAC instrument is a type of debt security that in this particular instance, we've listed it as a social bond on the JSE. So these type of instruments, the reason why it becomes important for us is because it helps us to build a more resilient banking system. It helps us to ensure that we can withstand and absorb losses should we need to. And that then allows us to continue focusing our current lending activities on ensuring that we deploy capital into the SME market, that we can confidently grow our SME lending book, and we can take the risk of lending to SMEs. It gives our investors and our clients confidence that we're able to do that. The second part of the deal that I'd just like to highlight is actually the technical assistance part. And I get really excited about talking about the technical assistance because this is valued at $1 million. And it is going to be targeted at women-led SMEs. And I'm very confident that the deployment of that grant is going to have direct and tangible benefits for women businesses.
Felicia, let's look at that technical assistance grant in a bit more detail. What sort of assistance does this then provide for those women-led businesses? We are firmly in Women's Month, just a couple of days away Yes. from Women's Day. And I think it's quite an interesting proposition to then put forward to women-led businesses. What sort of assistance are we talking about here?
No, absolutely. So the assistance that we're talking about are targeted interventions that we will use the technical assistance grant to fund. Maybe I just want to touch on why it's so important that we're targeting this towards women entrepreneurs or women-led businesses. We really feel that women represent a very vulnerable segment of the SME market. And it's, you know, it's because they've been historically disadvantaged because of that traditional role that women play in society. So they, you know, women have not had the access to the education and opportunities that our male counterparts have had. And because of that, you know, they might have additional challenges in actually setting up and running successful businesses. So we're looking at addressing those challenges. So let me speak about three interventions that we're working on that will be funded by the Technical Assistance Grant. The first of these initiatives is enterprise development programs. So we've got two programs, the Saudi Development Program and our Women in Business Boot Camps. And both these programs are really amazing because the participants will have access to experts across different domains of the business where they need to master certain skills. So in practical terms, if I need to understand how do I develop a marketing strategy, how do I manage the financials of my business, how do I manage people, you know, how do I understand labor laws? So all of those critical skills that a business owner would need in order to run their business, the women-led SMEs that are participants of these programs are going to get the access to those skills development interventions. The second initiative is access to our Simply Blue Card machines, but at a much more affordable price point because we're going to be using the technical assistance grant to discount the devices. And that is going to be used to help women-led SMEs that need to digitize their cash flow. So these are businesses that might primarily be dealing in cash, and this is going to help them to actually accept card payments and move that cash flow digitally so that they can it can then be recognized on their account. And then the third initiative is access to our BizFlex loan product. Our BizFlex loan product is a very popular product for us because it has very flexible repayment terms. So what we're going to do with the technical assistance grant is to significantly reduce the costs of that loan to make it more affordable for women-led SMEs to access finance through that loan, and they can use the funds from that loan to grow their business. So those are the three interventions, and yeah, we're very confident that it's going to have really great benefits for women-led SMEs.
Felicia, before I let you go, I want to take a look at the broader impact that this particular initiative alongside the FLAC instrument would be aimed at having on the entrepreneurial and SME space of South Africa and the African continent. We know that small businesses are the lifeblood of creating jobs and keeping the economy going, especially in difficult times. What more can be done or should be done to support small businesses, especially if businesses are finding it that financing and access to financing continues to be their biggest hurdle?
Yeah. So, Jimmy, I think to answer that, let me start by just, you know, explaining, I think, what it comes down to. What are banks actually looking for when they consider whether or not to lend to an SME? And I'm really going to just strip it down to the bare bones here. So I think one is affordability. We're looking to see, you know, is this business profitable? Can it afford the repayments on the loan? And two would be creditworthiness. So, you know, the business might be able to afford the loan. They have funds to repay the loan. But the question is really, you know, can they be relied on to repay the loan? Do they have a good repayment history, et cetera? So I think what's really important is to make sure that as an SME, you understand what the bank is looking for, that they're looking for these two things. And as a bank, it's important for us to make sure that we're guiding our SME clients on how they can show and prove profitability and creditworthiness. So a practical example would be proving affordability is ensuring that you're building your cash flow history. That is important. So, you know, an SME can do that in two ways. They can consolidate their cash flow if they're multi-banked into one account, or they can digitize their cash flow, as I mentioned in one of the initiatives earlier. And that's going to help the bank to actually see the turnover come through the account. And it's going to help us to be able to score them for lending to make it so much simpler and easier for them to get access to those funds. So that's practical things that, you know, a business can look at in order to make sure that they're able to get access to funds from the bank.
Supporting small businesses and ensuring that there is adequate financial and structural support for these businesses to continue to grow. The team at Standard Bank announcing a 5.4 billion rand deal with African Development Bank to support small businesses in South Africa. This feature was brought to you by the Standard Bank Group.
Look, being able to say my partner and I have traveled to 52 countries in 5 years is a great conversation starter. But that's not why I'm a client of Standard Bank Private. It's for moments like these. Babe, will you marry me?
It's not what you do that matters, but who you do it for. Get up to 50% back in UCount Rewards points on domestic and international flights. Search UCount Travel Mall to find out more. Standard Bank. It can be. Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
Did you know? Recent rain does not always mean your soil is at field water capacity. Omnia can help determine plant available water, giving producers a view of their planting risk profile. It's one more way Soil Insight helps reduce production risk. Omnia Nutriology. Better farming starts with understanding your soil.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
There was a conversation I had at some point with a gentleman named Peter Major on the mining landscape in South Africa and on the African continent. We discussed matters around beneficiation and the importance of beneficiation. Following on from those conversations, I suppose these conversations have been happening at a broader level as well. The government of South Africa, particularly the Department of Mineral Resources, is potentially exploring the idea that mining rights should be conditional on beneficiation. Now, the simple condition and the simple rule has the potential to fundamentally reshape the mining landscape, and it has been met with some concerns, some valid concerns, by the Minerals Council of South Africa. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with the Chief Executive Officer of the MCSA, Mzila Mtenjane, joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Dr. Mtenjane, lovely having you on our show as always. You and I have spoken about the beneficiation aspects of the mining sector and the latest potential rule around the conditions to mining rights. One would think would be positive, but they do come with some area of concern.
Good evening and thanks very much for having me. Maybe just a point of correction, it's actually not the DMPR that has at least place that as a policy intention. It's the DTIC in the Industrial Development Strategy. And this is what I had gone to at least defend for the mining industry at a parliamentary colloquium yesterday of the DTIC. And there was an invitation to a whole lot of stakeholders who could potentially be positively and negatively affected by the strategy. So you're absolutely right that, you know, one would think that a proposition for the beneficiation of our minerals should be a positive one. And in all accounts, it is, and it should be. Our argument is really the manner in which this proposition is being approached. We don't believe that there should be a condition on the granting of mining rights, that there should be attached to it the need to then beneficiate those minerals further. Our argument is that mining is a very specific industry and sector, distinct from beneficiation, which essentially is manufacturing. And interestingly, you know, beneficiation doesn't often, or at least in the debates I've been involved with, it doesn't seem to be seen in the same category as manufacturing, but in actual fact, that's what it is. You're translating a raw material into something of a high value and getting it closer to an end-use product. In this case, it's minerals, and it's no different if you take an orange and make orange juice. And that is the essence of our argument, that manufacturing needs to be looked at distinctively as a different sector, given its nuances and the incentives that it provides. Mining in itself also requires a very nuanced approach in order to ensure that you secure the exploration of minerals, the extraction of those minerals, and the two are related, and manufacturing actually requires security of supply of these minerals. And we believe that the current approach that the DTRC is taking could actually jeopardize that whole value chain.
Speaking of the approach, Mzila, I want to take a look at some of the other aspects that have been proposed by the DTIC, as you rightly corrected there, around potential taxation and the restriction of exports. This is something that would also have quite an impact on areas like the chrome sector. We are a country that is known globally for its minerals, for its mining capabilities and capacities, and that potentially is a strong point that we could be using to continue to drive investment into our mining sector. How do we do that carefully without kind of missing some of these areas that could detract from there?
You know, it's a different conversation why we haven't done so for the past, I mean, and maybe for the past 150 years that we've been mining gold and several other commodities, we have taken advantage of the value that we've obtained from these minerals, particularly gold. And we can talk to the city of gold, Joburg, not so much in its current form. It's another conversation. But I want to take you back to, you know, when Eskom was established. Eskom was established under very difficult global economic conditions for South Africa. And it was established in order to enable industrialization in South Africa. And it was established such that it could provide the cheapest electricity. And it achieved that goal. And out of that, we had, and this was at the time, a government-owned entity, ISCO, which was a conglomerate of mining, firstly across different commodities, coal, iron ore, zinc, and some of those companies are individual companies today, like ArcelorMittal, Exxaro in coal, and so Kumba Iron Ore, and so forth. We had IDC from a financing perspective, but I think the key message here is that for effective industrialization and beneficiation, if we stick to that word, electricity is absolutely critical. Firstly, in terms of reliability of supply of electricity. And secondly, and also equally important, the cost of electricity. And so beneficiation then becomes not a topic only related to chrome or ferroalloys, but across any other raw material that the country may produce from its natural endowment. And this was the primary argument that we made when we were engaging with Department of Electricity and Energy and DTRC, which finally led to the granting of a very favorable tax tariff, electricity tariff, for some of our ferrochrome producers. And we're hopefully going to see that extending to other energy-intensive users. So I think it's about making sure that we focus on the right issue. And not think that beneficiation for its own sake, without a consideration for market and what makes beneficiation happen cost effectively, you know, it is about electricity and cheap electricity.
Mzila, before I let you go, I want to take a look at how it is that we can push the beneficiation conversation forward. It has been a conversation we've been debating and having quietly and, I suppose, more loudly more recently, but they are alternative ways that we can advance our beneficiation agenda, especially from a mining perspective. How then do we start to position that beneficiation conversation such that it does still benefit the mining industry and other industries in South Africa without the need for putting undue pressure on perhaps legislation and some of the other mechanisms that we have?
And that's a fantastic question, and it's one that I spend a lot of time thinking about. And part of my responses to that very question for me is that I think we need, as a country firstly, and this is a question a lot of African countries are asking themselves in this new scramble for minerals. How do we get the most benefit out of our minerals? If you think of the things that we need to build in our country in terms of infrastructure, public services, housing, and so on and so forth, all of these materials come from mining. And so my first response to that question is that I think a long-term and clear economic plan from government in terms of what are the things that people need to live and work and to play, and how do we build a country such that it demonstrates, you know, advancement in and prosperity in terms of the way that people travel, where people live, and so on and so forth, that infrastructure. I think what that does, it immediately creates a demand for mining, for exploration, for minerals. And I think in the context of that long-term plan and a sizable market, it then attracts the investment that is required across that whole value chain to ensure that we're able to build the things that are going to make people live better. And so I think that for me is one thing that is still missing in terms of a long-term South African economic, socio-economic development plan that will create the necessary demand for not only minerals, but it will be across other key natural resources, food, for instance. As people become more prosperous, they're able to buy more. So agriculture will face exactly the same thing or will have the same opportunities. Technology, innovation. And so we'll begin to see pretty much the whole nation being brought into this growth path, which will then lead to prosperity. So I think the important thing is that we shouldn't have a conversation about beneficiation in a very closed up, isolated way, absent of a consideration of everything else that I've mentioned in terms of an economic plan and how we can make change people's lives going forward.
A plan for prosperity, an economic plan for advancing South Africa and moving us forward as a nation. Beneficiation is a part of that conversation, but it isn't the only part of the conversation. We'll leave this one on that note. Mzila Mthenjane, Chief Executive Officer of the Minerals Council of South Africa, joining us to take a look at beneficiation and some of the potential unintended consequences if it is not implemented correctly.
Did you know that South Africa has one of the highest crypto adoption rates in the world? Fact. With that comes massive innovation and new opportunities. Stablecoins are the new buzzword in the industry. These are crypto versions of the Rand, the Euro, and the US dollar. But what's coming is even more exciting. Being able to borrow against your crypto and buying tokenized real-world assets such as stocks, wine, football teams, and real estate. Join me, Kieran Ryan, on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast each week to stay on top of what's happening in the fascinating world of crypto.
I'm Nobukhanya Mdambo, the host of MoneyWeb's small business podcast, Mzansi Business, built around the real voices of South African entrepreneurs. This is where the conversation becomes real, where business owners share what it actually takes to build, not just succeed, but survive. We shine the spotlight on local businesses, their challenges, growth, and what it takes to succeed. Each episode becomes a moment of truth, a decision point, a lesson, a turning point in a real business journey.
The podcast delivers deep, honest conversations with entrepreneurs navigating real decisions. This is where trust is built.
Money, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
SME of the Week is powered by Capitec Business Banking. Start out or scale up with Capitec, the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP, FSP number 46669. Terms and conditions apply. It is SME of the Week time, my favorite part of the show, because we get to speak to small businesses and find out how it is that they have conquered some of the toughest challenges that confront businesses to achieve all the success that they have. This week's small business has come all the way to studio to tell us about their business and what it is that they do. I'm joined in studio by the founder and chief executive officer at Boo Campus Media, Dave McKenzie, to get a sense of what it is that their business gets up to. Dave, lovely having you on the show. Thanks for coming, Jimmy. All the way to studio. Tell us about Boo Campus Media. What do you do?
Boo Campus Media, what we do is we help universities to raise what they call third stream income. So alternative income, which effectively goes back to the universities, which ultimately one way or another goes back to assist the students. So we had to create an infrastructure which is funded through advertising, and we had to take that to market. So that's the end of the story. The beginning of the story is not quite as smooth and as easy as that sounds.
Take me through that beginning, because from what you're saying, it sounds as you said, at the end of it sounds all easy and simple to do, but as somebody who's done a lot of work in the campus space as well, I know that to build the kind of blueprint that you speak of here is not something that happens overnight. Take me through the journey of building the business and how it is that you finally arrived at saying this is the working model.
Yes, okay. Thank you. I think what happened was the Fees Must Fall movement was the catalyst. So we saw that the students were hurting and that they needed additional funding. And Campus Media is a subsidiary business within the greater stable of our business. And we knocked on UCT's door. So I've got UCT to thank. They had a very forward-thinking executive director of finance who had understood that third stream income was critical to their growth. Knocked on their door and said, guys, we've got an idea. We think that we can create a multimedia platform on universities where advertisers would love to utilize them. And we'll do a revenue share model where for every rand, as an example, that we raise through utilizing this infrastructure, which we will build and map out for you, let's call it 50 cents on the rand goes to the university, 50 cents comes to us as a business, but we will run and we will work on risk and let's see where we can take this. So that was really the first initial discussions. Fortunately for us, I think our timings were good because typically, as you would know, academic institutions are not as commercially orientated as many businesses would like. And so I think if we'd approached them prior to the Fees Must Fall movement, this may not have been a priority for them. Suddenly, third stream income was a KPI written into a lot of the job descriptions. And again, with the vision of the financial director, he put in place a new position, a head of business development, to look at these sorts of things. And the kind of initiatives that the universities were looking at was, do they go in-house with their coffee shops? And will that raise more money than a franchise type operation? And we were just one of those multiple legs, and that was media. So with a university, they don't always just allow unsolicited bids to be tabled and then be appointed. So what generally happens is it needs to go out to tender. And they have a procurement business that looks after all the procurement of university services across South Africa. So we had to go through a tender process with their procurement company. We were fortunate enough to win the tender. And I think we were lucky enough to have a bit of a head start on our competitors because we had already in our minds, we had unpacked what this was going to look like. It was a big part of our vision. And then we started to meet with various parties within the university, UCT to start with, to understand how does a university operate? Because we had operated with shopping malls in the past. We had operated with business class lounges, with airports, and we'd done similar things in those environments previously. University, very different, academic institution. That had to be the priority at all times. And it wasn't about coming in and using advertising to make a Christmas tree of these amazing buildings and institutions. So the first thing we looked at was we analyzed how the university spoke to their students. And we realized that it was SMS and it was email. They also did have televisions in the libraries and et cetera, but they were using memory sticks. And of course, what starts to happen when it's a manual exercise, it's not quite as efficient as it should be. So content was possibly only being updated every week or every second week. And we said, well, there's technology that can enable real-time updating of content. So we developed a campus television network. And the pitch to them was that we would work with their communications and marketing teams, and we would allow them to use television screens as a communication platform to the students. Hmm. So I could go on forever. I'll stop there if there's anything else you wanted to ask about that.
Dave, I want to get your sense on Boo as a business? Many people don't know this is a business that is more than 20 years in the making. More than two decades of work has gone into building what the business looks like today.
Yes.
When you look at the business today, I imagine you still have dreams around where to next, right? So how do you, and I suppose this is also something that other small businesses might have a question about, is how do you decide when to scale, what scaling up looks like,
yes,
what this baby that you've nurtured for so many years, how to take that to the next level? What is the next level for Boo?
Great question. And I think sometimes I joke with people and say people become entrepreneurs because they were too scared that they were never going to be employed, or they're too scared that the role that they're in and where they may be a little bit too maverick is not always going to work within the corporate environment. And so therefore you have to start your own business. So that's number one. I think that's one of the drivers. Another driver, I think, is not looking over your shoulder. The one thing I've started to learn is it's great and it's an enormous amount of fun pioneering new, whatever business you're in. In our case, it's media platforms. It's amazing. As soon as you launch and it goes out into the public space, there are so many other businesses watching. They may not ultimately be watching you personally or your business personally, but they're looking for opportunities. And everyone thinks that they can do the same better. And so what starts to happen is just as you start to launch a new idea, you've got to absolutely think, how do I ring fence this idea to protect myself from competitors coming in and eating my lunch? And so what you need to do is you need to run hard. You need to bed down the initial proof of concept, and then you need to think about how do I protect myself from competitors. So let's call it that fear of failure is a very healthy fear of failure.
Dave, before we run out of time, where do people get hold of the Boo Campus Media business? If people are looking to partner with you, if people are looking to get in touch with you, looking to collaborate, how do people reach you?
Great, thanks. We'd love to. I think, firstly, before I give out my details, what we've started to realize is just how enormous this category is. And while we have built very strong relationships with marketers and media agencies and creative agencies, and they're amazing clients of ours, there are so many more companies that we would love to be chatting to who are also engaging in this space, because we've created the infrastructure, let's call it a funnel, that will allow many of the other operators that are trying or have bursary programs or whatever they may have, who want to then amplify that into our university spaces. They can literally go to the boomedia.co.za website. They can reach out directly to me. My email address, shall I give that out?
Sure.
Is Dave at boomedia, so that's boomedia.co.za. If I'm not able to assist, then I would point them in the right direction. We have a team of people handling all sorts of different areas of our business. But I would always want to be front and center on taking their queries.
A business that started out as a dream that grew into lessons and growth beyond measure. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Chief Executive Officer of Boo Media, Boo Campus Media, Dave McKenzie, joining us this week for our SME. Inspired by the SME of the week? Start your own business or scale up and save up to 50% on fees with Capitec, the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP, FSP number 46669. Terms and conditions apply.
If you're running a business, you know the sound. That's growth. Another customer. Money in the bank. Why should your business slow down for your bank? With Capitec Business, it doesn't. You get lower fees, faster credit approvals, and bankers who know your business. Now that's progress. Bank on better with Capitec Business Banking. Capitec is an authorized credit provider. FSP 46669. Initiation, service fees, and conditions apply.
It's just gone 7 o'clock. Greg Hurst is standing by with the latest round of evening news, followed by the top sport team. From my side, good night.